Welcome back, everybody. Today, we're going to be taking a deep dive into some passages from Isaiah.
Oh, yeah, Isaiah.
Yeah, he's a pretty intense prophet.
Definitely.
A little cryptic sometimes.
Cryptic is a good word for it.
So we're going to be looking specifically at chapters 11 and 28 today.
Okay.
And you sent me these excerpts from a lecture by Robert Van Ooy.
Oh, yeah, Van Ooy.
Who is analyzing the writings of Old Testament scholar John Oswalt.
Okay.
And New Testament scholar E.J. Young.
Interesting combination.
Yeah, so we're going to be looking at those two scholars and their different viewpoints on these passages.
Yeah, these passages are really interesting because they deal with these themes of judgment and restoration.
Yeah.
But you know what's really the kind of head scratcher here is, what do these concepts look like in practice?
Right.
Especially when we're dealing with a prophet like Isaiah, you know? He's known for his layered prophecies.
Yeah.
His symbolism can be really tough to unpack sometimes.
Yeah. Let's start with Isaiah 11, verses 11 through 16. It paints this picture of God gathering his scattered people from the four corners of the earth.
Right.
And Oswalt seems to think that this is pointing to a future literal return of the Jewish people to Israel.
Hmm.
And he even connects it to the Zionist movement.
Wow.
And the establishment of modern Israel in 1948.
Okay.
But here's my question, though. Haven't Jewish people always existed, even when scattered throughout the world?
Yeah, that's a good question.
What would make this regathering so unique?
Well, Van Ooy actually highlights this point that Oswalt makes.
Okay.
About how the Jewish people have maintained their identity across millennia,
mm-hmm.
you know, unlike a lot of other ancient civilizations. Mm-hmm. Well, think about the Babylonians, Assyrians,
mm-hmm.
the Moabites.
Yeah.
They've all kind of faded into history.
Right.
But the Jewish people have persisted.
That's true.
So that makes their return to Israel after centuries of exile even more significant.
Yeah, that's a really good point. It's like finding a seed that's been buried for ages.
Yeah.
And against all odds, it sprouts.
I like that analogy.
Now, here's where things get really interesting.
Okay.
E.J. Young takes a totally different approach.
Mm-hmm.
He sees this passage, figuratively, as a representation of the spread of the gospel and the unity of believers in Christ.
Okay, so not a physical return.
Not so much.
Interesting.
So for Young, it's not about a physical return to a specific location.
Okay.
He believes the four corners of the earth represent the global reach of the gospel.
So it transcends physical borders.
Right, bringing people together in Christ.
I see.
So is Young saying this passage has nothing to do with a physical return to Israel?
That's exactly what he's saying.
Wow, two completely different interpretations of the same text.
That's amazing, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a lot to consider.
Yeah, it is.
But before we get too far ahead of ourselves, Van Ooy throws in a little caution here.
Okay.
He reminds us that while the return to Israel in 1948 is certainly significant, it doesn't necessarily mean that all the prophecies about Israel's restoration have been fulfilled.
Oh, interesting. So there's more to it than just the physical return.
Right. He argues that true restoration involves a turning back to God.
A spiritual renewal.
Yes. And that hasn't happened on a large scale yet.
Hmm. Makes you think.
It does. And he even brings in Deuteronomy chapter 30 to support this.
Oh, wow. Deuteronomy.
Yeah. It talks about how a complete return would involve not just a physical homecoming.
Right.
But a genuine change of heart towards God.
So it's about the internal as well as the external.
Exactly. It's not just about being in the right place.
Mm-hmm.
It's about having the right relationship with God, too.
I see. So there's a deeper level to this whole idea of restoration.
Right. And that leads us to Isaiah 28.
Okay.
Where things get a bit more dramatic.
Dramatic. Oh, I can't wait.
Yeah. So in chapter 28, Isaiah shifts his focus to Judah.
Oh, okay.
And it starts with him calling out the drunkards of Ephraim.
The drunkards.
Which refers to the northern kingdom.
Okay. Got it.
But then he really shakes things up by directly addressing the Judean nobles themselves.
Bold move.
And let's just say he doesn't hold back.
I bet he doesn't. So what happens?
Well, picture this. You're at a lavish feast.
Okay. I'm picturing it.
Everyone's having a good time.
Sounds fun.
And suddenly, this prophet shows up. And basically calls you all a bunch of drunken fools.
Oh, my gosh.
Talk about awkward.
You said it.
The irony is pretty thick, right?
So thick you could cut it with a knife.
And the way these nobles react is amazing.
How do they react?
They basically scoff at Isaiah's message.
Really?
Yeah, they compare it to baby talk.
Wow. They're not taking him seriously at all.
Not one bit. And their response really speaks volumes about their mindset.
What do you mean?
Well, they see themselves as sophisticated and powerful.
Oh, I see.
So they completely dismiss Isaiah's message as simplistic and irrelevant.
Classic case of pride getting in the way of truth.
Exactly. And Isaiah is brilliant here.
What does he do?
He uses this really clever wordplay in Hebrew.
Oh, I love Hebrew wordplay.
He repeats these phrases like sav lasav, kav lakav.
I could see how that would work.
Which mimics both the dismissive tone of the nobles and the babbling of a child.
So he's using their own arrogance against them.
Precisely. He's exposing their foolishness by using their own language.
That's so clever.
And what's even more fascinating is how Isaiah uses this wordplay to highlight a twist.
A twist.
By mocking God's clear message.
Right.
The nobles actually invite a different kind of communication.
Oh, what kind?
One they won't be able to ignore or misunderstand.
Oh, no. I'm getting a bad feeling about this.
The language of the Assyrian invaders.
Oh, wow. So instead of these simple words they could understand,
right,
they get stuck with a foreign language they can't even decipher.
You got it.
Oh, boy. That's definitely not a good situation.
Definitely not.
So what happens next?
So these Assyrian invaders become like God's instrument of judgment.
It's pretty intense. Right?
And they literally speak a language that the nobles can't understand. That's wild.
Yeah, it's like this divine irony.
It really is. It's like they thought they were too clever to need God's guidance. And then bam.
Reality hits.
And they can't even translate it.
Exactly. Vannoy's point here is that these nobles, with their pride and their drunken revelry, they had become totally deaf to God's gentler forms of communication. So they needed something a little bit more
shocking.
Yeah, a real wake-up call.
So the Assyrian invasion, with its foreign language and all the chaos that came with it,
yeah,
that became the message they couldn't ignore.
It's like God speaking through actions instead of just words.
It makes you think about how this prophecy isn't just predicting an event.
Right.
It's revealing something much deeper about human nature.
And the consequences of ignoring God.
Exactly. Let's go back to Isaiah 11 for a second.
Okay.
We were talking about how Oswald leans toward a literal return of the Jewish people to Israel.
Right.
And Young interprets it as the spread of the gospel.
Two very different views.
Vannoy points out something interesting about Oswald's approach, though.
Oh, what's that?
He says that even when Oswald is interpreting the passage literally, he acknowledges that there's also a figurative element there.
Okay, how so?
Well, Vannoy brings up how Isaiah lists all these places.
What's that?
Assyria, Egypt, Pathros, Cush.
There's a lot of places.
And Oswald suggests that they're not meant to be an exhaustive list of every single location.
How interesting.
Instead, they represent the idea that God will gather his people from the entire world.
I see. So it's more about the concept than the specific places.
Right. It's like they're symbols for the vastness of the earth.
And the scope of God's power.
He can gather his people from literally everywhere.
It's a good reminder that even when we're dealing with potentially literal prophecies,
yeah,
we need to be aware of the poetic and symbolic language that prophets often use.
Otherwise, we might miss the deeper layers of meaning.
Exactly. And it sounds like for Young, there's no geographical element in Isaiah 11 at all.
Not really.
He sees it entirely as a spiritual ingathering.
Right, representing the spread of the gospel and the unity of believers in Christ.
That's a big difference in interpretation.
Huge. It has major implications for how we understand the relationship between Israel and the church.
How so?
Well, Oswald, with his emphasis on a literal return, might view modern Israel as a partial fulfillment of the prophecy.
Okay.
But Young would see it as completely separate from the spiritual fulfillment he sees in the spread of the gospel.
So it's not just two different ways of looking at one passage. Correct. It's two completely different ways of understanding God's plan for history.
And the role of Israel within that plan.
Exactly. And Vannoy points out how some people have interpreted the return of the Jewish people to Israel in 1948 as a sign that the time of the Gentiles is over.
Hold on, wait. What does time of the Gentiles even mean?
Oh, yeah, good point. It's this theological concept that refers to a period of time when God's salvation is extended to the non-Jewish nations.
Okay.
Essentially, the entire world beyond the Jewish people.
Got it.
And it's based on passages in the New Testament, like Romans 11, where Paul talks about the Gentiles being grafted into God's plan of salvation.
So some people believe that with the return of the Jewish people to Israel, that period of outreach to the Gentiles is over.
That's one interpretation. But Vannoy cautions against jumping to conclusions.
Sure.
He emphasizes that we simply don't know what the future holds for the state of Israel.
Right.
It's faced so many challenges throughout history, and it continues to do so today.
Plus, just because the Jewish people have returned to the land doesn't automatically mean that they've returned to the Lord.
That's a crucial point. That spiritual element is so important.
Absolutely.
A true return, as described in Deuteronomy 30, involves a complete spiritual renewal.
Right.
A turning back to God with all their heart and soul.
And Vannoy observes that we haven't really seen that happen on a large scale yet.
Right. It makes you wonder.
It does.
Yeah.
You mentioned something interesting about hearing from people involved in Jewish evangelism.
Oh, yeah.
And they've noticed a greater response to the gospel among Jewish people in the diaspora.
Those living outside of Israel.
Than among those who have returned to the land.
That's fascinating. It seems kind of counterintuitive.
It does. It makes you wonder if sometimes being scattered creates a unique openness to new ideas.
Maybe because they're exposed to different cultures and beliefs.
While being part of a tightly knit community, even in a homeland, can lead to a sort of insularity.
A resistance to anything that challenges the established norms.
Yeah. It's like a double-edged sword.
It really is. It challenges us to think about how our social and cultural contexts can shape our openness to spiritual truths.
But ultimately, Vannoy doesn't pretend to have all the answers.
Of course not.
He acknowledges the mystery of prophecy.
Right.
And he reminds us that God's plan is often unfolding in ways that we can't fully grasp.
So maybe it's less about figuring out all the details.
Yeah.
And more about staying open to God's leading.
Wherever that might take us.
Exactly. And recognizing that true restoration, both for individuals and for nations, is ultimately about a change of heart.
A realignment with God's will and purpose. That's a powerful thought. We've covered a lot of ground here.
We have.
And it's incredible how much depth and complexity there is in just these few verses from Isaiah.
Isaiah is full of surprises.
He really is.
Yeah.
We've explored contrasting interpretations of prophecy, the importance of historical context,
the different ways God communicates,
and the multifaceted nature of restoration. It's amazing how both of these passages, in their own way, challenge us to think about how we're relating to God.
Yeah.
If his communication can be so diverse.
Right, from like gentle whispers to...
Or like Assyrian invasions.
Yeah, exactly.
How is he speaking to us today?
That's the question, isn't it?
Are we tuning in?
Or are we being like those drunken nobles just dismissing his message like it's baby talk?
Oh, man, that's a powerful image.
It really is.
It makes you wonder, like, if God was willing to use something as disruptive and chaotic as a foreign invasion to get his people's attention back then, what might he be using in our lives today to shake us out of our complacency?
It's a good question to ask ourselves.
Yeah, yeah, it really makes you look at those like difficult experiences, maybe even painful experiences, in a whole new light.
Like maybe those are the times when God is trying to break through.
To get our attention.
Yeah, when he's trying to get us to see things from his perspective.
And that brings us back to this idea of restoration.
Right, which seems to be a theme throughout these chapters.
Yeah, as we've seen, true restoration, it isn't just about outward circumstances.
No, it's about an inward transformation.
A realignment of our hearts with God's will.
Changing from the inside out.
So it's not about getting back to some perfect time in the past.
Uh-huh.
It's about moving forward in a way that honors God.
And allows him to work in our lives.
Exactly. And that's an ongoing process.
Always growing and changing.
A lifetime of seeking God, listening for his voice.
And being willing to let him shape us.
Even when it's uncomfortable.
That's the hard part.
Yeah. It reminds me of that C.S. Lewis quote.
Oh, which one?
Pain insists upon being attended to. God whispers to us in our pleasures, speaks in our conscience, but shouts in our pains. It is his megaphone to rouse a deaf world.
Wow, that's a good one.
Sometimes we need that megaphone.
To wake us up.
And it might come in the form of a challenging situation.
A loss.
Even a global pandemic.
Yeah, anything that gets our attention.
That's what's so amazing about these passages in Isaiah.
What do you mean?
They're not just ancient history.
Right.
They're speaking to us today.
Challenging us.
To examine our own hearts and our relationship with God.
We've only scratched the surface of these chapters.
We have.
But hopefully this deep dive has sparked some new insights and questions for you to ponder.
Absolutely. Keep exploring. Keep wrestling with these ideas.
And most importantly,
keep listening for God's voice in your own life.
Yes.
Until next time, happy diving.